Welcome to the Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're revisiting why we chose careers in service, what that says about us and about our families and our communities, and about our country. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Alexis Ludwig. Alexis is a retired senior foreign service officer, an assistant professor of national security strategy, and the author and publisher of the Unbreaking News Substack, featuring foreign service type stories and reflections about past episodes and current events. Alexis, thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you. And I wanted to commend you on the initiative of this project, and not only for the idea, but for actually picking it up and moving it. Many of us have ideas, not too many of us, and I include myself in the category, go to take the next step and implement and go with the idea. So congratulations for that.
Well, thank you. I feel very fortunate to be able to do it and to have so many inspiring friends and colleagues who are willing to participate. And you actually reached out to me after listening to the podcast, and I'm excited that people are starting to do that, and I'm meeting new people as well. So it's all good things. So about you, I'm really interested in starting where I usually start with people, which is, how were you raised? What was important in your home? And how do you think the values and priorities that your parents instilled in you set you up for your career in public service?
My mother, French born, she came to the United States when she was already in her early 30s. She didn't speak English at the time she arrived, but she learned very well. And several things, I'm mentioning her because she's an absolutely formative influence on my own development. She learned English as an adult, always spoke with a very strong accent, but actually spoke English better than most Americans do because she was a great reader and came to really appreciate the nuances of English. And I want to say two things about her. She had a deep appreciation for people who asked genuine questions. And she actually said something that I'll never forget, and I tell people now. In fact, I tell people students who I teach that it's amazing what a good question, a sincere question, can do to create a conversation to actually make people like you. Which it doesn't have to be the aim, because it really has to be sincere. But she said, and it's amazing how few people do it. Mm. Why do so few people ask questions? Because there's so much to learn from other people. So that was one thing. And the other thing that I just wanted to mention, often, is because I guess I'm a first generation American. Both of my parents were from Europe. My mother was French. My father was German. But my mother also had more than a pet peeve about people, Americans, who somehow react to people who speak English with an accent, mm-hmm. as though they're stupid. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that from other foreigners, and I say, and when the exact reverse is true, if somebody is speaking a language, let's say English, with an accent, what it means is that they speak another language better than you do. Anyway, that was another, just to start out in that way about my mother.
Yeah, what is that quote? It's something, I'm paraphrasing, so I'm sure this is not exact, but I heard the quote that a foreign accent is a sign of courage. You know, it means someone came to a new place and took on learning a new language, new customs, new culture, and they were outside their comfort zone that entire time, and it's a sign of bravery.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a sign that you have at least another culture and another language to draw from. And to go off on a little bit of a tangent, I came to public service a little late in life from a sort of, I was a wannabe writer. And I actually still argue that the writers of English who came to English from another language are among the best we have, if not the best. So, Vladimir Nabokov. I used to be a James Joyce fan, but I think Vladimir Nabokov, because he comes from an incredible wealth of linguistic background, Russian, French, and the others, his English has a richness and depth that no native speaker can even come close to approximate. Joseph Brodsky, another Russian, is the same, mm-hmm. a Nobel Prize winning poet. Anyway, so I have a deep appreciation for languages and what that can bring
to your own. For asking questions, too. So you mentioned that asking questions is a really great way to be liked and to show your curiosity about somebody else. How did that play out in your career as a Foreign Service officer?
Well, it's absolutely critical. It's absolutely critical. And I think we discussed earlier in our offline conversation that in order to ask a good question, you actually have to be prepared. You have to do some research. You have to know something about the issue or the person in order to ask the question that will reveal something new that you don't know. And I always said to people who worked with me and eventually those who worked for me that was their job, was to ask the kinds of questions that would reveal new information. Your job was not to necessarily to know something already, but to find out something new, right? And if you're the person who knows the most about an issue X in any given room, if you're a diplomat, you're probably in the wrong room because you don't need to hear yourself talk. Asking yourself questions is asking other people questions is absolutely critical to gaining new information. And frankly, diplomats for the most part are professional listeners, right? Mm-hmm. You're supposed to learn new. If you're called upon to speak, there are certain limited cases in which you are actually instructed to speak. You receive instructions from your government to go and deliver a message. But besides that, there's no requirement to speak, especially if other people don't ask you questions. You're absolutely able to volunteer information, but you don't have to. You can just ask questions of your own and be the one who learns. So it's absolutely a critical dimension of diplomacy.
Did you find that difficult sometimes? Because I think culturally, like, I know you have European roots, you were raised in the United States. I think culturally, we're not always the best listeners. Did you find that it was difficult for you when you went out to your early assignments to be in listening mode, or was that natural for you?
I think maybe, God, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, but it's a little bit more natural for me. And I know that as a cultural trait, it's a terrible generalization, but Americans tend to like to share what they know, possibly overshare what they know. So I maybe made an effort deliberately to compensate for what I knew was a tendency by not pretending that I knew more about the country I was in. I'm also married with a foreigner, with a Central American, Guatemalan, and there's something that irritates foreigners about Americans when foreigners start preaching to an individual from the country about their own country as though they know better. So I kind of learned early on that you probably shouldn't do that. Even if you think you know, you should probably take it in first and then respond. So on a personal level, I don't remember having to adapt much. I'm very good at answering questions if there's a sincerity behind the question being asked. But I'm also very good at not speaking if the person is not very interested in listening. That's also a skill of diplomacy, is not saying what you don't need to say.
And understanding, reading the room, understanding what people are interested in hearing.
Yeah, my father was German, right? Mm-hmm. My father was German. He was the quintessential German professor. And he used to brag about being absent-minded, which I ended up kind of contesting being absent-minded as a sign that you're thinking of deeper things. But actually, I learned something from my absent-minded father. I learned to detect the very instant at which a person ceases listening to what you're saying. And it's a real skill, because you actually don't need to speak if somebody isn't listening, especially if you're with another person or a group. If they're not listening, there's no requirement to speak, right? So it's a real gift to not speak when the reception mode on the other side is not there.
Yeah,
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And so I can see how your parents contributed to and shaped the way that you undertook your career as a Foreign Service officer. What about your wife? Because you mentioned her background and the fact that it sounds like she's been pretty influential as well. How has she shaped you throughout your career?
Well, as people will know who have been married a long time, she keeps me honest. She reminds me when I do something that maybe I didn't realize I was doing. But yeah, absolutely, absolutely critical. But I think we were discussing one of the ways your family shapes your especially your career destiny is by sort of coming into the discussion about what you're going to do. And the Foreign Service is like, where will you be assigned? And I met my wife in Guatemala, my first post, which is sort of a stereotype of diplomats. She joined me in our second post, which was in Tokyo in Japan. And so it was a real kind of shock adaptation. She had never lived outside her country. And I always thought that I was going to serve most of my Foreign Service career in East Asia, because I had gotten a degree in East Asian studies at the University of Washington and in Seattle. And I was very interested in Japan. Japan was rising. And I had done three consecutive tours in the East Asian and Pacific Bureau. But on the third one, and we were in Malaysia. We were in Malaysia during 2001. And for my wife, who's from Latin America, Southeast Asia is very, very far. It's actually just multiply by two almost the time it takes to get back. And she basically said, you know what, we're not going to Asia anymore. So from there, I pivoted and went to South America. So she's very much shaped or helped shape the trajectory of where I actually served and what that means. I'm very grateful. I had a fantastic career in Latin America, but it wasn't the East Asia career that I thought, partly because my spouse.
Yeah, and you also started a family, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We have two sons who grew up in the Foreign Service. One of them was born in Arlington, Virginia, and at right when Med gave the clearances, we were off to the races to Kuala Lumpur. The other one was born in Kuala Lumpur, and I think he still remembers one phrase of Malay, because Malaysia is one of those countries, the majority of the countries in the world, that just because you're born there doesn't make you a citizen, even though there's a special category for diplomats. Even in the United States, they don't become citizens. They're not given birthright citizenship. But Bukan Warga Negara is really in bold letters on the bottom of his Malaysian birth certificate, means non-citizen.
Okay.
Yeah.
I made it clear.
Yeah, absolutely.
So on the thread then of place, you are from California, right?
Absolutely.
How did growing up in California shape your thinking and your way of moving through the world?
I was one of these Foreign Service officers who didn't know that I was going to be a Foreign Service officer. I grew up, and I actually never set foot in Washington, D.C. before the day on January 2nd, 1994 that I joined the State Department of Foreign Service. I never really thought of Washington as an option. I had other career ambitions, and it was fine. You know, for many countries, the capital city is absolutely critical. I think of France, where Paris is absolutely central. Tokyo is, they even have a word in Japanese that if you're going up, you're going towards Tokyo. If you're going down, you're going away. And I'm saying all this by way of prelude to the fact that the United States is a federal system. California is very far away. California was sort of, I'm a West Coaster at heart. I went to graduate school in Seattle and Washington. So I never saw Washington as part of my destiny. And I also maintained a very, 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 very acute identity as a West Coaster and as a Californian. I became a proud Californian. In a way, I think of James Joyce, who played the role of being Irish when he was outside of Ireland. I ended up playing the role of being a Californian when I was outside of California, including in the Foreign Service. So one of the ways that I actually used it, I hope to my advantage, I know that I irritated some people once in a while, that when a foreigner would ask you where you're from, that can be a little bit of a loaded question, as Foreign Service officers know. We're proud Americans. It's a great country. Not everyone agrees with that, and some people have a problem and view the United States as in a negative light. So in certain circumstances, if somebody says, where are you from? I took the liberty to say, oh, I'm from California. As I used to say, it takes the bite out of being American, right? Who's going to criticize you for being, and then of course it's, and then I would sometimes have a joke, especially with this, I would reserve this joke for my Texan friends. I worked for two Texan bosses. So when they were around and I was asked the question by a foreigner, I would say, well, I come from the single most important state by any measure. whether it's population, whether it's political representation, whether it's economic might or cultural reach, you name it. And it was done as a joke, and I was surprised that about half of people didn't guess correctly. The obvious answer is California, right? It's not, some people said New York.
Well, it's obvious to a Californian.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think you're getting at the concept of cultures and subcultures and how we have many subcultures, within our country. And then there's your community and there's your family and there's so many different levels here. And I think identifying which level best represents the parts of you that you want to share with the person that you're talking to, and doing that in a way that's subtle. And, this identity maybe represents a lot of assumptions, and you're kind of leveraging those assumptions in a positive way is really interesting and really strategic. And I also like your point that sometimes leaving a place actually reinforces that identity for you even more. Like I grew up in upstate New York and I didn't think that much of it until I went to the South. And then I was like, well, I'm a Yankee, and that's just how you feel once you leave that place.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, to make a pitch for our public diplomacy and our cultural exchanges in the IVLP program, the International Visitor and Leadership Program, which is facing a reckoning now. It's one of the most valuable things that we do. We bring young, promising leaders to the United States to get to know it, because as most American diplomats know, the United States sometimes suffers from being overly well known but poorly understood. A lot of people believe, because the United States is so prominent, a lot of people think they understand the United States when they actually don't. And you have to correct the The IVLP program is a fantastic way to correct the misperception of the United States as a monolith, right? As one thing. So they'll go to Washington, maybe New York City, but then they'll go to Alabama or to Montana. They'll say, "Hey, wait a minute. Actually, the United States is many things. It's many parts." I used to say, the United States is California and Texas and Montana and Alabama. It's all these things. So it's not just one thing.
Yeah, and true for so many other countries as well, and that's something we can relate on.
Absolutely.
So in your life and your career as a Foreign Service officer, what skills or qualities helped you the most? What skills were the most important in your career, and why?
Well, I think we've kind of hinted at some of them to begin with, and I think that I'm going to quote Bill Burns, who's probably our single most prominent career diplomat, who reached the deputy secretary ranks and was CIA director under Biden. But he defines the diplomat as the translator of the world to Washington and of Washington to the world. So one of the real benefits that diplomats bring to their country is they bring an understanding of the perspective that the other country or region or group has of the world or of a problem, right? And that's it sounds simplistic, it sounds like a truism, but it's a really deep insight. Because, for example, that we won't get off onto a political tangent now, but Washington has a tendency of being Washington-centric and viewing other countries as though somehow they don't exist. That tendency under the current regime is even more pronounced. It's as if we can say we're going to impose tariffs on the world because it's in our interest to do so. Well, I think a diplomat will automatically recoil from that, because they'll think, well, what are the other countries thinking about this? And shouldn't the views of the other countries, let's just start with Canada or Mexico, both of whom had a free trade agreement with the United States, what do they think about that? For that matter, what does the People's Republic of China think? And it's not because it's nice to know. It's because it's absolutely necessary to know in order to craft an approach that will actually work and not create unintended consequences. So the skill that I would bring is that skill of listening and really trying to figure out how that other country, whether it's a small country like Guatemala or Bolivia, or a large country like Japan or Brazil, believes about this issue, and trying to bring it honestly. At the same time, obviously conveying the US point of view of the problem to that country, right? So it's a job I ended up really relishing. I didn't realize just how much I would enjoy it. Just being predisposed to want to understand and to knowing that other people do view the world differently, and that it's just useful. Not only is it useful, it's absolutely vital for our national security strategy or for our diplomacy to know what other countries' view is and how they are likely to respond. Because if we don't, we're flying blind. So I would say that,
Would you say, so like strategic empathy?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how, I've never taken the Foreign Service exam, and I don't know what it looks like now or how that differs from what it looked like when you took the exam, but I'm going to ask you to reflect back, you know, more than 30 years. And can you recall what the exam experience was like? And do you feel like the process of taking that exam actually captures these kinds of skills that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a good question. You're taxing my memory here, because I actually I took the exam in the early 90s. I know it's evolved a lot, and I was following the iterations of the evolution. And I do remember that the exam really was about current events and political structures at home, which are very valuable, because you do need to have a basic understanding of how our own government and system works, and have some familiarity with current events. But I also remember that the part that seemed to be most important, of course, there's two parts, there's the written and then there's the oral. But what was given a lot of weight, I think, thankfully for me, because I was not necessarily a foreign policy junkie or a wannabe diplomat for my early adulthood, was the emphasis on English language ability. That I think the Foreign Service is really seeking people who know how to speak and write, who know how to communicating effectively is a core diplomatic skill. I'm not sure if it does a great job of capturing the ability to listen, which when I'm, you know, my last year in the Foreign Service, I actually helped launch the core skills and diplomacy course. And one of the buckets or categories of skills is effective communication. And I always insisted on that needed to begin with effective listening, right? You need to know what another person is thinking, or frankly, reading the room is a kind of listening. Like, before you act, what is going on here, right? And without it, you can't speak clearly, because you might be speaking to a misreading of the room.
Right.
Or so anyway, I'm not sure that an exam can capture that. Perhaps the oral exam did it in ways that I was not consciously aware of at the time. So
hopefully. But I think some of the most important skills in all jobs are some of the most difficult to quantify and assess. So it's an interesting thing.
Oh, absolutely. So I'm the obsession with quantification is kind of alien to my approach. So when people start speaking of data, I say, you know, I'm glad there are people who are doing data, because I appreciate the importance of making sure you know what you're talking about in measurable terms. But I think that's not the forte that I would bring to the table.
Same. Yeah. So tell me about, I would like to hear about your best day and your worst day in the Foreign Service, and you can choose which you want to lead with.
I loved being a diplomat. The Foreign Service, I kind of like the foreign part. So I know there's different Foreign Service officers who do. My forte was not the Washington side, and that's when the people who really rise to the top have to be really good in Washington. I acknowledged that was never going to be my strength. So I really liked the overseas part and figuring out what was going on, figuring out how we could work together. So a good day would be one in which I get prepared. I'll read up on what's going on. And I have a good lunch meeting with an important, say, journalistic contact that we have a great discussion. Or for that matter, I'll give you a concrete example. When I was in Malaysia, I would meet periodically with one of the lawyers for the then imprisoned former deputy prime minister, who happens to be the prime minister of Malaysia now, by the way, Anwar Ibrahim, who was imprisoned on trumped up charges by the prime minister, who thought Anwar a threat to his rule. So I would meet with one of his lawyers for lunch. And basically, we would just talk like two friends. And it was really the establishing of rapport. And we would talk about anything under the sun that was happening. And then there would be 10 to 15 minutes of, quote, business. But we definitely would not start out with the business. So the relationship building aspect with the key contacts could be a journalist, could be a lawyer, could be, frankly, a foreign ministry contact. I'm still mm-hmm. in very close communication with a friend that I met when I was a young officer in Tokyo, who's now a senior official in the Argentine Foreign Ministry. And he's a lover of the United States. He's a student of the United States. So I always bounce ideas off of him. And we talk, for example, about Javier Milei in Argentina now, who's the famous the bearer of the chainsaw that Elon Musk has used. And by the way, I know this is not what this podcast is about, but the comparison between Argentina and what's going here does not work. I'm willing to have the debate with anybody who disagrees with me. But I love the exchange. Mm-hmm. I love the exchange of different points of view, finding out, hey, what's happening? How was Pope Francis's death viewed in Argentina? I reached out to him recently. I wanted to hear about how I know how Pope Francis was viewed when he first burst on the scene as Pope, but I wanted to hear how he was being bid adieu in his own country.
And what was your worst day on the job?
Okay, this is kind of easy, and it kind of goes back to my, I wouldn't say distaste for Washington work. That's a little strong. I really learned to appreciate that you need to understand how the system works and what the system requires from mm-hmm. from overseas. But there is a little bit of a bureaucratic nature to it. And I think on my
a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I'm being euphemistic. I'm speaking Foreign Service euphemism speak here. But I still remember a day. I think I spent my entire workday in my third tour trying to get a memo whose margins and whose font was not perfectly according to the standard of the front office at the time. And I think, as I look back on it, I probably hadn't established a good working relationship with the lead OMS of the front office. And I think she probably wanted to yank my chain. But I literally went back until late in the day. I had a headache, and I'm not sure I actually got the memo cleared. I think it happened the next day. So that was a pretty bad day that is still memorable. There are others, but I won't go down that memory.
Well, I think that one is relatable to anybody who has worked within the bureaucracy. To go back to your best day and your insights about relationships and just getting to see how others view the world. One of my favorite things from my time at the State Department was I was sitting in Washington, but I would get to read cables from our posts around the world relevant to my work. And I loved reading the cables that were coming from a couple of ambassadors at small posts who clearly had really deep understanding of the context of the country that they were in, and they added a lot of nuance and flavor to what you would otherwise see in the news. And getting mm-hmm. to read that and understand on a level that I think you could never see otherwise unless you were there, kind of how things were playing out and how culture was influencing them, was one of my favorite things. I miss that. But I relate very much to the relationships and the cultural access kind of element to your answer.
Right. And it's critical, actually, to underscore the point in the interagency policy coordination process in Washington.
Yeah.
As people who have participated in these IPC meetings, usually overseas missions are there by video teleconference. Mm-hmm. And usually after, you know, the IC will present, and then the NSC senior director will ask, please post. The post views on what's happening on the ground, like, and you know, is the president's stepbrother who's in charge of that bank, what's his view, right? Mm-hmm. Who else is going to have that kind of granular information but the post? And that's what they're there for, and it's extremely valuable in the Washington context to have that. You know, the Treasury folks are probably better economists than the economic officer, but the economic officer will probably have a much more detailed and nuanced understanding of the realities on the ground in that country.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So we're getting close to time, and I really love to end on this question.
Okay.
What is your greatest hope for the future?
Yeah, that's a good one. So I am out. I'm retired, and foreign service and civil service folks are bound by the Hatch Act during their careers. We're no longer bound by the Hatch Act afterwards. I still think of an ambassador that I worked with who I really enjoyed. She ended up respecting foreign service officers who worked for her for their restraint. Because, your personal opinion can't really play a role if you're representing a government. Totally understand now. But right now I'm sincerely concerned about the fate of our union, if you will, of our constitutional republic in a way that I never foresaw I would have been when I was working inside the system. And what my hope is that we're able to overcome this difficult moment, that the forces of democracy, of the forces, the what I'm going to call the pro-constitution forces, prevail over the other forces that I believe are dominant in the current administration. And again, I always refer to myself, I believe honestly, if not perfectly accurately, as a rabid nonpartisan centrist when I was in the system. So I don't speak as a partisan when I'm saying this. I speak as somebody authentically concerned about the fate of a government system that, for all its flaws, is highly functional. And especially on a comparative basis, those of us who have spent most of our careers working in developing countries that have genuine problems, for example, with taxation, where the rich people don't pay taxes because they point to the corruption in government, becomes a vicious cycle. And you see that there's a certain oligarchic class that benefits from government dysfunction because it justifies the non-payment of taxes, etc. I would hope that we are able to stem such a vicious cycle here before it becomes hardened. It's a real hope. It's tinged with genuine concern, and I'm trying to figure out what I can do about it besides writing about it, besides inviting others to join my Substack. And pointing out to people like Michael Lewis, who've written good books on the importance of public service, including Who Is Government, or others like Don Moynihan on Substack, who are pointing to the importance of what we have, including in his recent post on the National Park Service. I mean, I have sincere hopes that we can preserve, strengthen, streamline, of course, a functional government and not let it, I'm not going to use the verb. I'm not sure what verb to use.
I get it. I get it. And I think that you are kind of bringing us back to this point about listening, observing, taking in information, because much of our foreign policy and the conversations around foreign policy are focused on what we articulate and project outward. But equally important is what we take in from the rest of the world and how we are in conversation with the rest of the world. And so I think you're highlighting the invaluable experience of foreign service officers who have spent decades traveling the world and developing intimate knowledge and understanding of what's going on in other countries, and that we can learn so much from their experiences and from the contexts that they've existed in and navigated so skillfully.
Absolutely. 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 I mean, we know the United States is a powerful country, probably still the most powerful country in the world. But if you don't understand how the People's Republic of China is going to respond to, say, tariffs, and you don't have a reading on the ability of the Chinese people to endure, you don't have an understanding of how this could play out. So absolutely, it's not good. It's not would be nice to have. It's absolutely essential and critical to have that understanding because we live in a big world and we're not alone in it.
Absolutely. That's a perfect way to end. Thank you so much for your time, for your thoughts. And I also want to thank you for your many years of service to our country and for continuing to engage in these conversations so thoughtfully.
Well, thank you for your initiative, and I really hope that it flourishes and that it is spread far and wide. I'll do my part to spread the word.
Well, thank you so much.